For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So welcome, everyone. Welcome, Douglas.
Thank you.
You can bow with me. I would also just like to make a special welcome to people who are new with us this morning, who had Zazen instruction, and I'm grateful to the people who also, to Paula and David Ray, who assisted this morning. So, it's summertime, a little humid, Square Roots Festival is happening, and yet still we come to Zazen. So, bring forth the Dharma together, and Douglas is going to offer our talk, and he is our Tanto, which is head of practice, who helps keep the forms and ceremonies and general spiritual container together for us. So Douglas, please say anything else you'd like to say about yourself and the Dharma.
That will do it for who I am. Speak about the Dharma. Good morning.
Good morning.
It is fantastic to see so many people who have come for Zazen instruction, knowing that there might be people like pick the topic for discussions. My big hope is that I don't confuse you or conflict too much with anything Ogetsu said during Zazen instruction. Let's give ourselves a chance to take maybe five breaths, just sitting here, upright in Zazen posture. Not trying to do Zazen, don't do Zazen. Just sit here, not trying to do anything. And just feel this posture and feel your breathing. So, just sitting like this, in this posture, being present with everything that's present to us, our surroundings, our bodies, and internal perceptions, the feel of sitting in this posture, the feel of our breathing, our thoughts, emotions, desires, whatever's going on in our minds. Just doing it in that way is just sitting upright like that without trying to attain anything, not trying to do anything, is itself awakened love. And so I wanted to talk this morning about that, but also as a jumping off point from that, read a story, a koan, a practice story, from the gateless, the collection of koans called the Gateless Gate. This is case 19. It's usually called Ordinary Mind is the Path, is the Way. When Zhao Zhou asked Nanchuan, what is the Tao? Nanchuan said, the ordinary mind is the Tao. Zhao Zhou said, well, how should I strive for it? And Nanchuan said, well, when you strive for it, it recedes. You turn away from it. Zhao Zhou said, well, if I don't try, how do I know I'm on the way? And Nanchuan said, well, the way is not something known or not known. Knowing is false perception, it's ignorance, delusion. Not knowing is just being oblivious or dull. If you you truly arrive on the way that is free from doubt, you will realize that it is vast like open space, through and through. How is it possible to impose affirmation and denial? And at these words, Xiao Zhou was suddenly awakened. So, koans are an important part of Zen tradition. In some schools of Zen, you actually sit some of the time with some koans and just do zazen and keep that in your mind. In our tradition, we don't really do that, but we talk about them all the time. This is a koan involving a famous Zen teacher from the Tang Dynasty, Nanchuan, and his student Zhao Zhou, who maybe is the greatest Zen teacher in the history of Zen. He was renowned by not being acting as crazy as some Zen teachers. Nanchuan is one of those. There are lots of koans about Nanchuan in the three main koan collections. There are many more about Zhao Zhou. But one of the crazy koans about Nanchuan is really one of the most famous koans. This is a very famous koan. But an even more famous one is called Nanchuan Kills the Cat, where Nanchuan comes in and he sees that monks from the east side and west side of the meditation hall are involved in some sort of argument about a cat. And nobody knows what that argument is about, whether it's, well, there shouldn't be a cat in the meditation hall, or, well, this is our cat. No, it's our cat. Whatever. So Nanchuan, just in response to this argument, picked up the cat and pulled out a knife and said, if anybody can say a word of Zen, I won't kill this cat. Nobody said a word, so he cut the cat in half. And later, Zhao Zhou came in, and Nanchuan told him the story about this, and Zhao Zhou put his shoes on his head and walked out. And Nanchuan said, well, if you'd been there, we could have saved the cat. So, this koan is much more discursive and ordinary. It's not like that at all. So I hope it's not like that at all. Anyway. The idea, another title for this koan might be, instead of ordinary mind is the way, it might be, don't try to do zazen. Because of the fact that we are already awakened. The awareness that we would try to cultivate is with us all the time. It's already there. The only thing we need to do is recognize it and just be willing to be awake like that and to intend to stay awake like that. But efforts just get in the way. There are a lot of names for that state of mind. Bodhi. Ordinary mind. The founder of San Francisco Zen Center, Shunryu Suzuki, called it big mind, and so did Dogen, the founder of our school of Zen, Sutu Zen. Or big eye. Suzuki Roshi said big eye more than big eye. And big mind is the mind that's aware of everything that it's around you. Everything in your experience, your entire field of awareness, everything in your field of awareness, all these surroundings, everything you can see, hear, smell, the feeling of your posture, your breathing, the thoughts going on. All of that is big mind. And Suzuki Roshi would say, big mind is a mind that contains everything, which you would call big self, big I. And he would say, big mind. And he would say that what we do is just come back to that big eye and to the big mind over and over and over again. realize that we are here as part of our surroundings. And by that, I don't mean that our body is here, physical body is here in the surroundings, but everything, including all of our perceptions, all of our thoughts, our emotions, and so on, are there. That's the big I. I think I sort of lean towards saying, well, it's really our, it's not just that our life is part of our surroundings. Our surroundings, it's our life. It's everything that is in our awareness and that we affects us. That's our life. So we're waking up over and over and over again to life. That's always there unless we become distracted in one way or another. And that's why, but at any rate, since that awareness is always there, that's where ordinary mind comes. Ordinary, it's sometimes everyday mind, but the characters for ordinary mind, everyday mind, suggest it's the mind, continuous mind, permanent mind, something that's always there. So that's what ordinary mind is trying to emphasize. And that's our practice. Our practice is here we are, over and over again. That's the foundation of everything we do and say, here we are. So, you know, in the koan, you know, I think it's fair, it's easiest to break the story down into segments to talk about what's going on. It's a whole idea of we don't try to do zazen. Mind is already there. So, Xiaozhou asked Wenjuan, what is the way? Wei, Dao, what is the Dao? It's a loaded term. It's the way, it's the ultimate truth of the world and how it works, and it's how we should, it's the teaching about it, and it's how we should live, what we need to do in order to realize the way and to live in harmony with. In that sense, it's very similar to a Buddhist term, dharma. Dharma and Tao are different in their understandings of what is sort of the big way, how it goes. Tao is really talking more about how does the universe work? It's in polarities that are in harmony, and everything in our life operates in polarities too. Dharma is not like that. It's a little bit different. But at any rate, Najuan says, ordinary mind is the way, we've talked about that. And Xiaozhou says, well, this is ordinary mind is the way. So, in order to understand what follows, we need to understand that when you say ordinary mind is the way, big mind, big I, necessarily implies that there's a small mind and a small I. Suzuki Roshi, in his wonderful book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, spends a lot of time talking about what small mind is, explaining that it's the mind that's related to something else. It's dualistic mind. It's the mind that is involved with, caught up in thoughts and emotions and desires and feelings that divide the world dualistically into this and that, good or bad, like or don't like, right and wrong, all of those kinds of things. That's how our mind works. Our mind, we perceive some object. And that object can be a physical object, it can be an imagined object, it can be an object of awareness, it can be something in a fantasy, a memory, it can be an idea, it can be a word, it can be a situation, whatever our mind can conceptually saying there's a this, that's a, there's a this, I'm perceiving some this. That's small mind. There's a this or a that, it's a small mind, and Zen and Buddhism generally would say, well, and that's a mistake, that's a delusion. There is no this or that cut off from everything else. There's a this and that, which can only be understood together. This is our whole life, our whole world, everything comes up within that. So you can't really talk about, nothing is really a separate, independent, fixed thing. But we think about them all the way. We have that sense that we are. We get caught up in, we perceive something, and we automatically decide, well, you know, something is pleasant, an experience is pleasant or unpleasant, maybe it's neutral. Beyond that, we start conceptualizing, but from a sense, a profound sense, here I am, and I see it there, well, I see myself here. So if that is fixed on some object out there that I am perceiving or thinking about or feeling upset about or happy about, then there's a me here too. This independent, separate, fixed me that's here. Because we feel that way, we come at things, not just that are unpleasant, it's more pleasant, but from this sense of vulnerability that something could go wrong at any time. If it's pleasant, then it could go away. I'm sitting here, I'm feeling like I really need something, I just have to have this, I think, or something bad could happen to me. And as a result, our life becomes, it's like preparing for a job interview. I remember in 2012, in my former life, I was an intellectual, I was a technology lawyer. And I had spent 10 years as the technology and privacy lawyer for Blockbuster Video, something long gone now. Right? Buddhist teachings, everything changes, everything goes. So I was unemployed for 6 months and looking pretty desperately for work. And I heard about a job opening at the American Medical Association, which seemed like a good fit. And I talked to them and got more information about it and got much more interested in it. And they said, well, why didn't you come in and talk to us? You know what the day before those interviews was like, right? I mean, you're there saying, I really need this job. I mean, the whole time, I was barely there. I was barely, to the extent I was aware of being on this earth, that was in the background. Everything was about that job. I really need this job. This would be a great job. I really want this job. I really need this job. It's going to be horrible if they turn me down. I hope these people like me. I hope they don't think I'm a jerk. I hope they don't think that I'm unqualified. And they actually made it kind of worse because I had to interview every single lawyer who was in that department. And I had been with the general counsel and the associate general counsel who was going to be my boss. I had like 3 sets of interviews. And then they brought me in and I had to speak to their outside counsel who were doing all their technology work so that they could test me and make sure I really knew what I was talking about. And then they'd ask for 3 references. Because I worked usually with C-suite people and with chief information officers who were always very busy and don't return their telephone calls, I gave them a list of 9. Okay, if you don't get one, just call the next one on the list. So the associate general counsel called all 9 of them. It's booked all 9 of them. I started getting these telephone calls. You know, who is this guy who called me and spent 45 minutes on the phone asking questions about you? Normally I expect people to say, can you confirm that Douglas Floyd worked at Blockbuster Video? No, he wasn't having that. And so after that, they said, well, I want you to come in. So there, you know, everything has been cranked up to the max. And I am completely absorbed in some fantasy. And that happens even if you're not thinking about what's happening tomorrow. If something happens today, you've got some standard for how things are supposed to be, how you want them to be, or how they are. And then they're not. And then you have this emotional reaction. We cling to those ideas and get caught up in them. And it takes us away from the experience of we live in this fantasy. It's something we have invented. What we take is the real world. We inhabit this thinking and these emotions, these ideas. It's not that they are going on as part of our experience right now. No, our whole world is inside this imagined interview that's going to happen the next time. So that's the that is the basis for what that is, what's called dukkha in Sanskrit. When you hear that Buddhism says that life is suffering, it's really saying that life, dukkha is all pervasive. We are, things don't measure up. We're out of whack because we have these common things, expecting them to be a certain way, wanting them to be a certain way. And when they're not, we have this, we're intentional with things. So how do we not do that anymore? That's obviously what Jojo was asking. He says, okay, well, what's the way? How do I live with the way? How do I live in enlightened life? How do I wake up and live in accordance with reality? And Nantuan says, sort of reminds the way. Jojo's kind of going, well, I feel like crap all the time. What are you talking? I've got an ordinary mind. You must be talking about something else. And in the way he is, and in the way he isn't, ordinary mind is the way to say it. It's the point that just as at the beginning, when we sat here and were aware of we were present with the world, present in the world, present with our thoughts, present with our emotions, expectations, whatever. Stepped off. So we were all of those things, all those expectations and desires and reactions are just part of right now. So that's part of your ordinary mind. And so all of those things are part of just being here, part of awakened mind. But the problem is that we need to deal with that clinging mind, our thinking mind, our discursive mind, our emotions, our feelings, our hopes, our fears, differently. We need to step back from them. And when we step back from them, and you're no longer sucking all of our attention away from our entire presence in the world, then we're back at big mind and big eye. But Jiangshou says, well, okay, how do I do that? How do I strive to attain ordinary mind? And Jiangshou says, well, if you strive for it, you're ignoring it. You're turning away from it. It recedes from you. And that's right. Because what's happened then is you say, okay, well, how do I wake up? Well, I think I'll strive for it harder. I want it really bad. So even our practice can be caught up in that small mind. We can become the severed small I as we imagine this state of awakening where I don't feel anxious and frustrated and afraid or angry anymore. That's just part of it. So we need to step back and open up to being right here, present. That's what our practice is. It's opening up, coming back, opening up the small mind, opening up the small I, coming back to right here, being opening back up, coming back to big mind, big eye, over and over and over again. So, that raises some questions, right? I mean, well then, how do we get there? And the answer is, we don't have to do anything. Doing is getting in the way. Trying is getting in the way. It's the small mind. So we sit upright, breathing comfortably, eyes half open, and we're just present with everything that's present, with all of these surroundings, with my other people, physical surroundings, my body, feeling my body, feeling the breathing, letting the thoughts rise and fall, even painful feelings, fear, anger, anxiety, frustration. That's what makes this practice hard. It's not that, oh my God, I'm going to have to get up a half hour earlier in the morning in order to sit zazen. It's not, you know, or I'm going to have to go to bed a half hour earlier so that I can do zazen before I go to bed. That's hard too, but also doing it day after day after day, week after week. That's for the rest of your life, maybe. That's not the hard part. That's just scheduling. The hard part is having the courage to sit with and just be there with fear, anxiety, desire, feeling vulnerable, feeling impoverished. I need something. I really need that job. But when you do, when you aren't trying to cover those thoughts and feelings up, when you're not trying to suppress them, when you're not trying to ignore them, all of those things are fruitless. You can't. They don't go away if you do that. In fact, if you try to repress them, if you try to cover them up, try to push them away, it's like feeding. They'll be back. They'll be back stronger than they were before. So what do? You just sit there. And without that involvement, thoughts, this train of discursive thinking, these emotions come up, and they're not getting any support, and they're there for a while, you're just being with them, yeah, fine, yeah, I'm going to hang out with you. There's nothing feeding them, and I'll use a metaphor, and just say it's as if they discharge energy. And at the same time, we get used to being with them, so we're not so freaked out by them. And then they go back. They disappear. And you'll have seen this in your own zazen. How long did you guys listen to this?
Well, maybe about 3 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. I think you'll find this happens most of the times when you sit down, that your mind will be very, very active. Lots of thoughts. Lots of emotions, lots of feelings when you first sit down, and they twirl and twirl and twirl and twirl, you get this right. You come back, you sit there, adjust your posture. Thoughts and emotions, feelings, twirl, 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 twirl. In about 10 or 15 minutes, come and all of those things are discharging your energy and your mind sort of slows down a little. That's what usually happens. It doesn't happen all the time. It doesn't happen. You can have really strong feelings come. It doesn't work. Except over the long run. Multiple periods. Maybe even weeks. Somebody has died. You're going to die. You get the news that, oh, by the way, you have pancreatic cancer. You've got 3 months to live. Sitting down, probably the fear and anger and upset, it's not going to just go away after 15 minutes. But that's okay. You don't have any choice. You're still feeling those things, whether you're sitting zazen or not. And as I said, trying to push them away or ignore them is not going to work. So you just sit with them. And over time, they will discharge their energy, or you will get accustomed to it, or you will find a framework that allows you to work with that reality. I think it's good. I can't give you a reason why that works or how that works, but that's how it happens. And I think there's a good explanation. So Xiaozhou says when Nanjuan says, well, if you're caught up in trying to become enlightened, you're trying to do zazen, it's not working. Your trying is getting in the way. You've just got these ideas, and your trying is getting in the way. You're focused on doing that rather than just being here and being awake. So Xiaozhou says, well, how will I know if I'm not trying? Well, how do I know that I'm on the way? He's still saying, well, I've got to get from here to there. I've got to do something. I have to fix this. And Nanjuan is back saying, you know, it's not about knowing or not knowing. knowing is just delusion. Big mind isn't something you know, it's something you express. It's just, it's a way of engaging with this reality of your life. That not knowing, it's so it can't be, it's not some concept. Oh yeah, I understand now. Oh, I've had this experience. Oh, I... That's not how big mind works. That would be a small mind. It would be part of big mind, but it's not opening up. And not knowing, I don't know what you mean, Judge, by not knowing, but it sounds very like, much like, just dullness, being confused, just being oblivious to this reality of right here. That's something that's always here with you, right in front of you. If you truly arrived on the way that is, you would realize, it's vast like open space, through and through. How is it possible to impose affirmation and negation? This or that, good or bad, right? Because our life is a good or bad, right, wrong, like this one, the whole universe. You can't say that. You can say that about some individual thing, and that's fine, as long as we're not absorbed in living within that clinging, desiring, thinking, and feeling. So, just sit here. Just let it go. Just be with whatever is with you. And that's the way. Small mind is just part of big mind. With that twist of perspective. Now you're aware of your thoughts and feelings in this experience of everything. All of your surroundings of being in the world rather than living inside them. And that is the way. Living, and then off your cushion, living from that perspective of, this is, I'm going to live life, I'm going to act from life, I'm going to live the life in which here we are, everyone is part of this. And I'm going to live with everyone as part of this. Anyway, my little alarm to tell myself to shut up is rung. So please, dragons and elephants, bring me your questions. Great, awakened, calm, settled people.
I did want to mention something. Then I misspoke when I said a few minutes of sasana. Actually, everyone here had a 35-minute period. So.
That's true.
You all help.
And you may have noticed that it's frequently the case. It may take a few more times for you just to find your seat, to get comfortable, and get used to that idea of not getting it, that I'm coming back over and over and over again, letting your mind do what it's going to do without interfering or resisting. But very quickly, you will find that, you will have that experience of your mind settling down and you opening up to being here, right in this world with thoughts and feelings. Just being alive. Being alive to your life. So congratulations on your first period of sasana. Yes?
I was wondering, I've heard of the Kamon Mu from, mm-hmm. I think, it's pronounced Joshu.
Joshu. That's a Japanese pronunciation of Jojo's name, yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if that, that Kamon is like the same idea. This, the idea of just sort of there's nothing, there is no answer to the question.
Well, I have to disagree. I think there is an answer to it. There are answers to the questions. There are responses to the question. But I think that something I've really appreciated is that there's a Zen teacher, James Ford, who likes to say that koans are about making issues clear. It's not about coming up with some answer or having some specific experience. So this, the Mu Koan is that Xiaozhou was an old man, and he was a teacher. He had started studying with Nanchuan when he was 18 years old, and he stayed with Nanchuan as a student until he was 59 when Nanchuan died. And then he left that monastery and following the practice and traveled from monastery to monastery, staying for a while, sitting in the meditation hall, taking jobs there. And when he was 80 years old, he stopped and settled in the monastery and started teaching students of his own. And he did that for 40 years, and he died when he was 120. And that question is, a student came to Xiaozhou when he was older, when he was teaching after he was 80, and he said, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Buddha nature is a pretty loaded term. In the end, it can mean, Buddha nature can mean the universe. The whole world as it is experienced by us. We're not involved with our small mind. We're not caught up in grasping parts of the world. Already read the Red Sutra to know that the answer is yes, a dog has Buddha nature. Because everything has Buddha nature. And a dog, after millions of lifetimes, also could become a Buddha. The dog is part of everything. The dog has Buddha nature. The dog has Buddha nature because he has the capacity over millions of reasons to wake up. But Xiaozhou said, boom, which means no. And says, well, does the dog have the nature? And he says, no. And so we have to understand, what is the point he's making there? A lot of these stories are about the point of we perceive things, but we also are aware of big I, big self, the world that we are a part of. What is the relationship between those two things? Because Buddhism isn't saying that there isn't a book here. But a book isn't a thing the way we normally think of things. Right? Because it's not separate from the world. It's not independent of the world. It's not going to be a permanent, eternal book. It's going to go away at some point. But it's absolutely there. It's absolutely part of this world itself. In some schools of Zen, Rinzai in Japan, the other school, the Mu Koan is usually the first koan you're given. And every time you would come to the Zen Center, to the every day in the monastery or during retreats, four times, usually five times a day, you go into the room to meet the Zen teacher and say, well, my name is Douglas, my koan is Mu. A student asks Xiaozhou, does the dog have Buddha nature? Xiaozhou said no. And then you would have to show that you understand what's going on there. Give a response that the teacher is going to accept. And most of the time, the teacher picks up the phone and brings it and says, that means, get out of here. Until sometime you give a response that the teacher says, okay. And then he gives you another call. We are different. Koans, we think about koans. Our practice, koans throw light on our practice. Our practice throws light on koans. Koans in our practice light up our life and what's going on in our lives. So it's different for us. It's similar, but it's different. I mean, we don't have to pass koans. We don't have to prove to a teacher that we understand them. Anyway, that's a long answer.
Thomas, is there some similarity, though, between this Mu and Wei? Or are they clarifying two very different things?
It's used in the same way.
I don't want to
there's
talk
so
about
many,
it.
No, there's so many. In the same way that Wei, Tao, is used for so many different ways, for the same sorts of things. What is the. How does the universe work? What's the world really like? How does it work? How do I get there? And how should I live to live in accordance with it? That's the same as, very similar to Dharma in Buddhism. But our understanding of Dharma is not, we don't look at the world with this dynamic polarity. So Tao is literally different, but in the early years when Buddhism was introduced to China from India, they already had these long-standing traditions of Taoism and Confucianism, and they started translating Buddhist terms using ones they were familiar with. So they would use Tao for ultimate reality, fundamental reality, awakened mind, enlightenment, and so on, which and there's a lot of overlap. So it threw some light on it, and also confuses.
Well, I was wondering if Mu and Tao both were the process of exploring and working with them is similar.
Yeah.
As a practice with the koan.
I think so.
I think that, you know, when you asked David, is there a similarity? There may be using some different content, but the focus on the kind of word and like opening with that.
Yeah, and to tell the truth, to practice with Mu, all this differs from teacher to teacher, but the most widespread practice in Japan is when you get the Mu Kuan. During Zazen, every time you would breathe out, you would go, recite yourself silently. It's almost like a mantra. Not, and different teachers would do it different ways. Some teachers would say, I want you to concentrate on Mu, I want you to concentrate on Mu 24 hours a day. I want you to go to sleep reciting Mu, I want you to wake up reciting Mu. I want you to concentrate on Mu so much you don't perceive anything else. Other teachers would say, no, Mu is a way of bringing you back to right here. So Zazen with Mu would be basically that way. It would basically be the experience of doing Zazen. It would be very much the same as counting your breaths or just being aware of your breath. It's a practice to help you be right here. In Taoism, there's a lot of meditation in Taoism. Some of the methods can be very different, but some are very similar. Meditating on the breath, just letting the mind go free. Other things can be very different. Yes?
No, I enjoyed your personal story of the job interview. I feel like I can relate to that in my current job. I do a lot of presentations, and so I'm a lot of times thinking of all the ways I need to prep for it, or afterwards thinking about judgment of how the presentation went and things like that. My question would be kind of knowing what you and the tendency to kind of get into the small mind during that process. My question is, knowing kind of what you know now, would there have been a different way that you would prep for that to have the small mind, be able to do the problem solving or preparing for the interview, but in the context of a broader, big mind? If that question makes sense.
Bringing that, all that planning, emotion, thinking into big mind would be helpful, because it's much more productive to get to work and say, okay, yeah, I get it. You're very nervous. You're thinking about that. And to tell the truth, it's also helpful because when you have these emotions and you step back and open up the big mind, the emotions are still there. The volume is turned down, sort of, on these emotions because the emotions and the thinking are no longer occupying all of your awareness. It's part of it, but they don't things magically go away. But again, yeah, I mean, there are different tools you could, different things you could do to bring yourself back. Just the fact that doing zazen on a regular basis means you just come back. Here I am. And then you say, okay, here I am. That's really how zazen works. I mean, it's not like we remember to be here. No, we get distracted. And then there's a gap in our thinking and you go, oh, okay, I'm back. Here I am. I'm willing to stay here. My intention is to stay here. And you sit there, just being present, right here, and then you get caught up in your thinking again. And then you come back. But doing that over and over and over again makes it more likely that you will come. And then there could be other things. People will set up, you know, timers. So every half hour, a bell will ring. Oh, okay, you're reminding me to come back right here.
So I think we have time for Anastasia, whose hand is up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I believe that's a hand. Is that right, David?
Look, is that?
Or am I
no,
not?
That's
oh, it's
my,
a cursor.
That's my cursor.
Okay.
I'm happy to answer other questions
during
tea.
Maybe we'll have questions during tea because these are great questions, and I'm hoping that Douglas can teach a little course on koans and ancient dragon realm time, which is his specialty. So, shall we chant our
Yes, let's do that.
We'll chant the four bodhisattva vows, and then we'll have announcements and work.
They're in the book on page 36.
Sarnamalas, we bow to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Karma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Karma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it.